Welcome to the Feminine Podcast, the official podcast of Feminine, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, Editor-in-Chief of Feminine.
And I'm Dara Cass, the other Editor-in-Chief of Feminine. Our guest for today's podcast is Dr. Risa E. Lewis. Dr. Lewis is a professor of emergency medicine and the director of point-of-care ultrasound at Thomas Jefferson University. She is also an important member of the FIX 18 Planning Committee.
Crucial member, super crucial member. With all of her New York knowledge, we wouldn't survive without Dr. Lewis. What? So, well, maybe. I don't know. It'd be rough.
No, it's not her New York knowledge. It's her specific knowledge of espresso and interesting cafes.
And places for parties. Okay, moving on. Today, we are talking about negotiation and this gender difference in our society that may affect the way we negotiate, the way we ask for things. We're going to start this out by talking about the book Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide, which is by Linda Babcock. Now, this book was given to me back in med school by a female attending surgeon that I was working with in med school. And it kind of blew my mind. It really opened my eyes to the way that these small things in our culture, these things that we don't even really see happening, are really affecting the way that our genders are acting in society. Now, Risa, I know this was a really influential book for you as well. You spoke about it in your FIX talk. Do you want to remind us about the big takeaways you had from the book and the message of this book?
Yes. So thanks very much for having me on the podcast. It is great to speak with both of you and everybody else in the feminine FIX world. So at FIX 17, I gave a talk. The name of the talk was We Are the Books That We've Ever Read. And I've mentioned before, I really like to read. And that books have played a very important role for me in developing professionally and in developing personally. And I was on my reading journey and I came across this book, Women Don't Ask, Negotiation and the Gender Divide. And this was an absolute game changer for me. It brought a bunch of things together. Growing up, I have a brother, a sister, a mother, a father. And my parents took to parenting in a very traditional way. They had very clear thoughts about what boys did and what girls did. And the specific connection with this book is every night we would sit down for dinner as a family at 6 o'clock. Dinner would end, and my father would always say, "Okay, girls, help your mother clear the table." And it really, really bothered me because I thought, why can't everybody clear their own dishes? Or why is this a girl thing? Like, why do we have to help mom? And so I would ask my father, well, what does my brother do? And my father would say, well, your brother takes out the garbage. And I would say, I want to take out the garbage. I actually prefer to take out the garbage. And I couldn't really put my finger on why this bothered me. When I read the book, Women Don't Ask, it completely answered and satisfied that feeling in my gut that things didn't sit well. So Babcock co-wrote the book with a woman named Sarah Lecheverus. And Babcock is a professor of economics. Lecheverus is a writer. And they looked at some of the research surrounding gender and surrounding asking. And it turns out that my little feeling in the gut and things not sitting right, there was a basis to it. The author herself, Babcock, talked about when she was working as a professor and she was working with graduate students. The women graduate students came to her complaining and they said, you know, we are teaching assistants, but the men, the male graduate students are the teachers. And we don't know why that is. And it really bothers us. So Babcock went to her dean and the dean said, yeah, that's true. And Babcock was like, why is that? Why are you doing that? And the dean said, well, the men asked, the women didn't. And that really sort of clinched it in terms of the asking, but also explained why, if you look at something like that happening at the level of graduate school, the men who were teachers had much more robust CVs, were therefore had much more competitive job opportunities, higher salaries, and a trajectory that was different than probably the women graduate students. So they tied that into talking about boys and girls and messages to the chores that happened in the home. And so in my example, where I just shared about what happened at our dinner table, girls are often encouraged to participate in chores that promote dependence and that there's this laboring for love, whereas boys are given tasks and chores that promote independence, like taking out the garbage or shoveling snow or mowing the lawn. And if you think about it, sometimes neighbors hire neighborhood children to do such tasks, and those hirees are often boys. So boys get this message of laboring for money and for some sort of reward. And one of the ways that this can translate is that boys are very comfortable asking for reward, asking for payment for their work, whereas we, young girls becoming women, are less comfortable and don't get the message that we should actually get paid for the work that we're doing.
Which only makes me laugh because in our house, secondarily, there's a chore chart, and my daughter, who's the oldest, is the one lobbying for payment at a certain number of chores done, and she's asking for real cash money. So I guess I feel like maybe this is the first indication that we have a raging feminist household in our house.
You're succeeding in your house.
She's like, why would I do anything if it wasn't for money? I'm like, because you're supposed to be contributing to the family, and she goes, I deserve money for that. So I appreciate the lessons here.
There's another point that she makes a little bit that like really resonated with me when I first read this book, was about kind of the nonverbal or kind of subtle signals that we send to our sons and daughters. And that's even things like, you know, when the family is going a place together, who's driving? Does dad always drive or does mom sometimes drive? Then do the kids get the message that mom can take the power for the car too? Or who's paying? You know, if the whole family is going out, I think she tells a story in the book about how they were going to pay for something once and mom, the dad wasn't there, mom was going to pay for it. And the kid says, oh, wait, you can pay too? You have money too? I thought dad just had the money, you know? So these nonverbal kind of really subtle messages that we send out into the universe really are picked up whether we realize it or not in an important way.
I totally agree with you. And that's a great point as far as like what children see as far as gender roles. But bringing it back to negotiation, because I think this sets up the framework for the first level of why negotiation outcomes might be different. The book, it says here, like talks about how negotiation makes women more anxious than men. Do you think that that's a thing, Risa?
I do think it's a thing. I think, now, we all did receive different messages and saw different gendered roles in the households growing up. But I always talk about how there seemed to always be a set of rules or a game book, a playbook that I never was privy to, that I, in my academic life, was seeing all these people navigate the world and get opportunities, get salaries, get titles. And I didn't know how that happened. And I remember I just finished residency training and the husband of one of my friends said to me, Risa, you should be absolutely positively embarrassed by what you ask for. And then you still probably haven't asked for enough. And he didn't really completely understand the gravity of what he was saying and the message. But he said, yeah, you should just ask. You just ask. But if we're taught not to ask, if we're taught that somehow our diligence and our accomplishments are going to get recognized and spontaneously people are going to award us, that doesn't always work. Sometimes it works, but not always. So, you know, this concept of asking and the anxiety is because we're not taught to do it. And so then we start doing it. We're afraid of rejection. We're afraid of no. We're afraid also that if you get the no, then you're going to lose the opportunity completely, as opposed to that there's a negotiation, there's a back and forth. So once I read this book and once I started speaking with, honestly, male mentors, I decided to practice. I decided to try it out. And I did a lot of that trying out when I was working in New York City with my chair. And I trusted the relationship, and I also wanted to get comfortable being told no. But what I was surprised by is every single time I asked him for something, he essentially said yes. And now I was producing in terms of academic publications, we were putting on courses, but you know what I was asking for was my own development as a professional. And he always said yes, but I was ready for the no. And what I found is you started being even riskier with those asks, and I just became very, very, very comfortable. Now, around this same time, one of my mentors took a look at my CV, and I said, "Can you take a look at my CV and tell me what's missing?" And he said to me, Risa, I noticed that you're not a reviewer for any journals. And I said, that's true. He said, why not? And I said, well, I thought, I don't know, somehow I had to get asked. And he said, no, you write to them. You say, I'd like to be a reviewer for your journal. Can I please be a journal reviewer? And so I sent a few emails, and the next thing I knew, I was a journal reviewer. I actually did not know it was as simple as asking.
You know, it's interesting because I think that, you know, as after we kind of tie up the book and we talk more about like our own experiences in negotiation and a lot of the fundamental reasons why I agree with a lot of the theories in this book, mostly as a study in gender and roles, the idea that women don't ask, I find a little bit cumbersome because I think that there's a lot more to what we're asking for than is the metric that we compare, which is money, right? So part of the reason a lot of the times when we compare, you know, have women successfully negotiated? Has anyone successfully negotiated as a society? Is we look at them and say, did they get more money? Right? We don't look at the same, the titles and the hours and the protection as much, although those are like kind of added on plus bonuses, kind of like the pork in a bill, you know, the extra stuff. But the fundamental transactional currency we have is money, right? And so I find that men generally, or those without multiple responsibilities, can go into a negotiation and only ask for money. And that the money becomes the thing they fight for, they stand up for, and they ask for what they think that they're worth. And many people ask for more than they're worth, knowing that it's going to come back to where they are going to be. Women, I think, and my experience, have come into a lot of negotiations with a multi-layered need, and money is one of those layers. And it may not be the top layer, right? And so they may get the top six things they need and then a salary that they're happy with, mm-hmm. right? And it's those six things that they're actually more nervous about getting than the money, which I do think is why negotiation makes women more anxious than men. I don't know as much if it's as much about not being prepared for negotiation as it is for feeling they have more to lose. Do you see what I'm saying? Like we had a conversation recently in a text chat I was in about scheduling. And about, you know, one person was talking about her schedule, another person was saying how, you know, how she reacted strongly when her schedule was changed. And for me, my schedule has been one of the things that has made me change jobs. It's probably the only thing. It's never been money. It's always been my schedule. And I find that women, when they go into negotiations, one of the things they'll bring to the table in a negotiation for a job is actually a schedule or time off or some other thing that they anticipate needing to make the job sustainable and to be good at the job. And when they negotiate for that thing, that's an easier thing to negotiate for the boss because it's not money, right? And so it becomes that focus of the negotiation and not the cash money that ultimately is the metric by which we compare success of negotiation. And so I wonder if, you know, part of my reflection on this book and on all these conversations around negotiation is, should we just all liberate ourselves away from asking for anything but money? Like, do we just make money the most important thing to all of us and then we can start comparing it? Because until we do, I don't think that we can compare that as the only metric of success for negotiation. Do you guys see what I'm saying?
So I think that's interesting. I think negotiation makes everybody a bit anxious. Some people have more fun with it and think of it as a game, but I think it makes everybody anxious. It's just whether some people are more prepared and set up for success than others. I don't know if it's about money. Because once I started learning about the way the world worked, I started asking, well, what's negotiable? And you find out things like office space, a title, a start date, a certain schedule. But some of the most extreme examples that I've heard of have been negotiations that men have been a part of, meaning men asking, can you please get us a nanny for the 6 months that we're there? When mm-hmm. I was negotiating and being interviewed for a job out west, this is a true story. A chair asked me if I had children, and I felt, I think this is a trick question. I'm pretty sure he's not supposed to ask me this. I have nothing to hide, but I ended up going with it, and I said, no, I don't have children. And he said, oh, good, because the last big recruit that we had to find a job for him and his wife, and then we also found a job for his former wife, because with his former wife, he had a child. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my goodness, I never knew that finding not just a job for your spouse slash partner, but also depending on who you are, you can even ask to get a job for your ex because you want your child near you too. So
no, but that actually is not uncommon in non-medical settings, right? So if you're negotiating for a job at like a finance firm or at a law firm, it is common for them to give your spouse a recruitment, like a recruiter to find them a job for relocation.
Yeah, right. So I've think heard of that. But the ex?
Yeah, no, even whatever your network is, like, you know, it could be admission to a private school or it could be a college admission. Like, there are lots of other things that people look for if they're going to be relocated that in the negotiation that you'd be shocked at actually what people will look at.
And does that happen in medicine? Have you heard of that happening in medicine so much? I've heard of it in like big, you know, business situations, but
I argue, I mean, in medicine, sure, if you're being relocated and you're a valuable asset, I think that one of the things that you know, in my house, we talk about a lot is what's valuable, right? Yeah. And, you know, when I talk to my husband about his negotiations versus my negotiations, you know, we have very different sets of parameters for what we need and, you know, what we're going to ask for. But the way he looks at negotiations is very different than how I used to look at it. Now I'm much more like him because he wins. You know, he gets what he wants. He comes out happy. Or if he doesn't come out happy, he comes out knowing that he asked for what he wanted and it wasn't on the table, or he's going to look for a new job.
But then it comes back to understanding and appreciating our own worth. I mean, like, you have to really think you're worth something in order to say, you know, find a job for my ex-spouse so that my kid is with me.
That's what I'm saying. It's not, I know everybody needs their support system. And if you're moving, you're moving. But the network that you can bring with you, that was a first for me.
No, but again, you don't know that. Again, that may have been his true bad. Like he needed that to move, and without it, he can't. And so, if that's really what you need, and without it, you can't move, then what's the danger in asking for it?
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing about negotiation, and that goes. I'm actually so interested that was, you know, somebody that was a complicated negotiation, and it was a guy, because I find that women get a lot more flack for being complicated negotiators, not because, you know, because we have more chips in our hand that we need to balance. But I like that this, like, here was a guy with all this baggage, right? And here was a woman who didn't have any.
Well,
and who got the job?
I actually think the reason we're thought of as simpler is a lot of people decide, they profile us and they think, oh, well, you're just a secondary income. Your income isn't as important as. So I actually feel like we're more often, this goes into unconscious bias, put into a bit of a box or a category. And that's why it happens that way.
Right. It's the man has a family to support and you're just the woman. So yours is not as important. That's an issue.
Right. As I believe I am the only dual income family of the three of us, I will tell you that I have been overtly told multiple times in negotiations that if there was a raise to be given, it was never going to be given to me.
Wow.
So that I didn't need it like somebody else did. Mm-hmm. And without apology. Hmm. And what's interesting is maybe I did or didn't, but I don't think that is not a fair assessment of my worth.
What was your response?
The first time it happened, I was kind of stunned and I didn't say anything. And then there is a bit of guilt because it is true. And I think that I am still then a collegial person. And if I can think of there is extra kit to give on some level, if somebody does need it more than me, let's just say that I never went back and said, no, give it to me.
Right. Yeah.
Because that's not who I am.
Right.
But that doesn't make it right to say it to me.
Right, right, right. Okay, so turning a little bit in a different direction, we are currently recording this during or in the aftermath of this year's Women's March. So I wanted to get to this topic, which is that there's some criticism that has been some criticism of this book.
That's been thrown at this book.
Thrown at this book? I'm not sure. Criticism that the concept of this book is anti-feminist in its nature, that if we can explain things like the pay gap, et cetera, by the fact that women have just not been asking, then that's putting the blame on the women for not asking. And that is an inherently anti-feminist concept. What do you guys think about that?
I think that's the classic blaming the victim argument, to which I do not subscribe. You know, I think there's more to it. I think community, society, and, you know, that there are messages and there are the way healthcare works, the way benefits work, the way salary works. It's not just imagined by women. Like, there's a structure. It's like institutionalized racism, except it's not racism. It's this institutionalized unconscious factors, unconscious biases that are at play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's, it's almost a straw man argument. No, this book is not anti-feminist, right? Because it's, feminism is not about like the infrastructure of the problem. It's about just women and men being equal, right? So it's not anti-feminist. Is it necessarily the only core of the problem that women don't ask, or that understanding why women have different needs and that gender roles play a role in that need and that affects how women ask, which is really what the book is saying, right? The book is saying we're raised a certain way that informs our cultural and kind of gendered role in society, that informs how we look at opportunities, and therefore that informs how we negotiate, right?
Right. It's not women don't ask, shame on you. It's why are women not asking and how do we address it?
Right.
Right. So I think that none of that is anti-feminist. I mean, you know, feminism has something to do with any of that, right? Like
right.
At the end of the day, like, you know, so I think that women, what women need, which may have been a better title for the book, but not nearly as drawing, is that we need more a lot of the time because we're doing more a lot of the time, right? And I also think that when we're raised in a different set of perspectives. Although back to Risa, how you were raised and how my kids are being raised, right? I drive more than my husband because he grew up in Manhattan and has a terrible driving record. He didn't get his license until he was a consultant after college. I almost always am the one with a pocketbook, and half the time my husband doesn't have a wallet. So I pay the bill again as often as he does, but it comes from the same checking account, right? And my daughter is the one that takes out the garbage because my husband likes to watch her carry the garbage outside the house. So, you know, it's like this funny thing where she picks it up and she's like offended every time that she has to touch garbage, and that's good for her. She should be touching garbage. Like she should be carrying it outside the house. So I think that maybe a lot of these issues and these gendered roles that were historically put on men and women or girls and boys are actually changing just by our society changing, with women being in the workplace, with them having their own salaries, with there being less of a cultural taboo on women drive, like, you know, kind of women driving in the family. Like it was more just a cultural thing. It had nothing to do with who had a license, at least not recently. So I don't think the book is anti-feminist is what I'm saying. I think that it's more just a societal or a sociological perspective on why women haven't asked the same way men have in the past.
I agree. I think it's a sociological study. And when I discuss the book, one of the, you know, the so what? It's not, you know, doomsday. It's okay, so what are our action items? What can we get out of this? What can we do? And I mentioned one about asking and practicing asking. But I also think there's a responsibility on, for example, the three of us to actually ask people to step up, ask them for positions, make things available to them. I've given examples of unconscious bias and about leaving people alone. The classic example is a woman is pregnant and she's been serving on a committee, and then all of a sudden she stops being invited to and receiving the notes of the meeting for the committee. And when she asks what's going on, her committee chair says, "Oh, well, you were pregnant. We didn't want to bother you." And sort of this decision made on her behalf, and that rather than making decisions for people, actually asking them, do you want to continue to be a part of the committee? Can we continue to have you as a co-leader? Things like that. So there's asking that goes both ways, both as the recipient, but also as the one making offers to people, sponsoring, mentoring, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You've had experiences like that.
Well, yes, I have more than once. But I think that also goes back to the podcast we did, one of the first ones we did, which was benevolent sexism, mm-hmm. right?
Bingo.
And how often do we presume what somebody needs because of their gender?
Bingo.
Right? And what's the best for them? It's like, well, of course you don't want to be on this committee because you're going to be a new mother. And we have no idea what that person wants because we haven't given them those options. And benevolent sexism just simply says, do not suppose what somebody needs based on some gender role that they somehow assume. So I think that's a pretty important point. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're right. It is up to us, and it is up to those of us that are paying attention to look to the landscape and be the leaders and to be the ones opening those doors and making sure that they stay open for those that may not be able to open it for themselves.
Yeah, I think that's great. I had entire other places I wanted to take this conversation, but that might be, you know, kind of how we negotiate for work, how we negotiate in the workplace versus how we negotiate in the home and things like that. But maybe that should be in a conversation for an entirely other day, because this has been such a good conversation already.
I think that that's actually a perfect thing to end on and to do for another day.
Yeah. We'll have Risa back and we'll talk about it then.
Awesome.
We know how to find her.
We do. I want to give a few announcements before we completely leave you guys to your day. And that is that we have an exclusive sponsor that has signed on to be the Fix 18 exclusive sponsor for the welcome party. And this is Butterfly. Butterfly is an ultrasound company. And Risa, I know you know a little bit about them. So tell us about Butterfly.
Sure. Butterfly is an innovative company that's changing the landscape of ultrasound, and I would say specifically point of care ultrasound. They have a technology that's actually being developed, produced, tested right in Guilford, Connecticut. And essentially, it's portable ultrasound, handheld ultrasound that will plug into an iPhone or an iPad device. And they have some pretty unique aspects to their technology that, number one, makes it durable. Number two, makes it much more affordable. And number three, it's completely going to change the way we can bring ultrasound to the bedside.
Yeah, I have to say, not as a totally random segue in life, when we were at ASAP, you know, the American College of Emergency Physicians conference last year, in another world, in another life, I am the director of medical director for an overnight camp. And I am working with a couple other doctors on how to deliver the best care we can to kids in camp. And I piloted this summer bringing an ultrasound machine to camp, and it was great. I had a great time. It really, you're talking about being miles and miles from the nearest hospital and x-rays and stuff like that. And point of care ultrasound has a really useful place in a low resource setting like that. And then literally as we see this portable probe that could plug into a phone, my partners and I, like in the camp company, that were like started drooling. Because the idea that we could deliver point of care ultrasound in an affordable and easy way to camps and in service a bunch of other doctors who are not EM on how to use it is really kind of groundbreaking and game changing in that space.
I mean, it's a game changer at camp, but it's a game changer in my department. I mean,
right?
Forget about it. If I had an ultrasound in my coat pocket,
right.
I can never. Finding a sauna when I need it. And then, of course, it's dead. And then I have to find a way to plug it in. But that means unplugging something else in the room and then moving somebody out of the room because I have to move a machine into the room. I mean, it's just crazy.
You carry it around instead of a stethoscope. If you had your own ultrasound, you would just never carry a stethoscope again.
I'm putting myself on the wait list for one of these right now.
I'm sure that they will be very happy with that. And then you can contribute to the party that they are sponsoring.
Fantastic. Okay. In other news, we are currently reviewing our speakers. Thank you to everybody for your submissions. We're so excited. It's overwhelming with the talent that's out there that wants to come to our conference. We are hoping that we have a lineup ready to announce sometime in February. So stay tuned. All right. So that's the end of our podcast for today. Thank you, Risa, for being with us. It's been a delight talking to you.
Thanks for the invitation. Really appreciate, and I love speaking with the both of you.
I'm sure we'll speak more offline, but I can't wait till the next conversation. And I appreciate both of you very, very much. And till then, we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.